Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Let's put aside whether or not Andrew was involved in the wrongdoing. Surely the right thing to do is to share what he knows about what were crime scenes.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find it on the ABC Listen app.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, the Coalition calls time on net zero by 2050. So what does the agricultural sector and big industry think about it?
Well, it's been a head-spinning few days when you start taking away some of the core principles here that makes business pause to think.
You'll hear from the Business Council and the Farmers Federation and the leader of the National Party, David Littleproud.
What we need is options at the moment. This government is putting us on a trajectory that we can't afford and we can't handle.
We'll also find out whether a key Republican's career can survive a fight with Donald Trump. And then back home, ahead of summer, and concerns about surf safety, why life-saving programs are being misunderstood by tourists and migrants.
30% of the beachgoers thought they have to be a swimmer between the flags. So in other words, that if they can't or if they don't swim, then they have to stay outside of flags.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, thanks for joining us for another week of The Breakfast Wrap on Radio National and the ABC Listen app. You're about to hear a number of exploratory and accountability interviews by Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. And first up, this question. Does the agricultural sector back the Coalition's dumping of net zero by 2050? What about big business? On the weekend, the Coalition ditched the commitment, but it promised to reduce emissions year on year, considering, quote, the real performance of other developed countries. Opposition leader Susan Lee also said that affordability would be at the heart of this plan, but she didn't outline when or by how much power bills should be reduced. Before we hear from her coalition partner, the Nationals, let's get the view of business. Innes Willicks is the CEO of the Australian Industry Group, and he gave Sally his impression of the coalition's decision.
Well, it's been a head-spinning few days. Quite exhausting, really, because we've had 20 years of the climate wars and we've had a couple of years of what you might call détente over some of the sort of broader principles that are at play here. There are four different aspects that need to be considered here when business and industry is looking at this issue. One is net zero, 2050, the agreed timeline up until the weekend. The issue of emissions more broadly, and energy. And energy is really front of mind for business at the moment, given rising energy costs. So, you know, what we'd hoped for, Sally, was some political agreement around, you know, at least the principles covering each of those areas. Very difficult to achieve, obviously, but to give business the confidence to invest. We're now at the point now where there's two, you know, quite different approaches underneath it all, and business will just have to see how that plays out.
Are you disappointed about the lack of certainty in the investment climate at the moment?
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty everywhere, but obviously business to invest needs as much certainty as it can have and to invest at scale. When you start taking away some of the core principles here or playing with them, that makes business pause to think around, well, what comes next? Will there be further upheaval in the years ahead that will impact the investments that I'm looking to make now? Investments take years from being considered to being implemented. These are not just overnight decisions.
From what you've seen of the Coalition's new policy, how easily will businesses be able to plan for the future, bearing in mind there are two alternative policy settings of the major parties?
For some, it will make them give pause. Others will push ahead regardless because they feel they have to in the current climate. But it's that uncertainty and that lack of settlement that makes it difficult. You know, where business is at right now, front of mind is energy costs. And, you know, obviously the coalition is making a pitch there, and we'll have to see how that unfolds.
With what the coalition has released so far, are you confident that energy prices would come down under the coalition's plan?
Without trying to sort of wriggle my way out of that, we need a lot more detail. From conversations with a range of people over the past week, it seems that they're opening their way back up to more coal into the system. They take, you know, if you were to go down that path, they take a long time to develop too, and there's been no investor appetite really for new coal-fired power stations now for a very long time because of the trajectory that we're on and the pure economics of it.
Innes Willicks there, the CEO of the Australian Industry Group. So what does the farming sector think about this new direction? National Farmers Federation President Hamish McIntyre spoke to Sally.
Does the National Farmers Federation support what's been announced?
Yeah, look, our position hasn't changed in agriculture, Sally. You know, the NFS supports an economy-wide aspiration of net zero by 2050, but not for agriculture. You know, food and fiber production must and always will come first. Farmers across Australia, you know, spend every day turning CO2 into food and fibre, and always have and always will.
So the NFF doesn't support net zero by 2050?
It supports an economy-wide aspiration, but agriculture has never been in, and we haven't changed our position in that area at all.
In this policy, the coalition will also focus on what's known as breakthrough technology that doesn't yet exist. So what are your thoughts on that approach?
Yes, look, I mean, there's all sorts of technologies out there. I mean, agriculture is at the cutting edge of new technology that, you know, improves our production and our viability. We've, you know, have many technologies that are working in around the farm fertiliser areas, and it will always continually change that area, but at the moment things are working well, and we are, you know, reducing our emissions naturally.
The Liberal leader Susan Lee says a carbon capture and storage has come a long way. What are the projects that you want to see funded for the farming sector?
Just what's already out there. I mean, there's great projects around soil-borne carbon. You know, organic carbon is very important to agricultural production, and that's going through our root system from our plants. That continues, and that's our best spot to store carbon, and we'll continue to.
Hamish McIntyre there, the National Farmers Federation President, speaking to Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. So get the sense that what many are looking for, as well as emissions reduction, is also a plan to bring down power prices. That's what Sally put to David Littleproud, the leader of the Nationals and the Shadow Minister for Agriculture.
Can you guarantee that electricity prices will come down under the coalition's plan?
And we'll have more to say about this, but what we've shown, and in fact could be implemented today. The first two measures is expanding the capacity investment scheme to all technologies that provide energy into our grid at the moment, rather than just prioritising renewables. What that would do is get that latent supply into the grid and keep it in the grid for longer. That means supply. The good old demand and supply principles adhere to that, having a downward pressure on prices. And then also the Australian Energy Market Operator is mandated to source energy solely through the premise of our 2030-35 target, which means there is that reliance on renewable energy. And if you took that away and mandated them to source the most affordable energy, then immediately you start to bring back the supply again in putting that downward pressure. You look at things like the safeguards mechanism, taking away the punitive penalties on that business are forced to pay, then again, that puts downward pressure again. So those are the first three things that the government today could do if they were serious. And when you just heard from Innes Willcocks about the number of businesses that are needing financial support because their energy is too expensive, then why wouldn't the government pull these levers today and
so,
say,
so returning this is to a way your to So returning to the question and your policy, can you guarantee that electricity prices would come down under your plan?
Yeah, and we will, as I said, we will demonstrate that as we move forward. And what we've also got to understand is we're 2.5 years away from the election. And what will change is the baseline of what you're paying now. I mean, you were meant to get $275 back this year from what you were paying in 2022. That was the promise Labor gave you. But we are seeing, not just through business, but through households, every quarter, their energy bill continues to go up. And so what we want to do is make sure that we are honest with the Australian people about what that looks like and what the baseline is in two and a half years' time, and that we can have those clear levers that we can pull straight away, like addressing the CIS, like addressing AEMO and the safeguards mechanism immediately to make sure. And what that does also, Sally, is also builds time and capacity for us for those coal-fired power stations to transition into nuclear or more gas or whatever it may be. What we need is options at the moment. This government is putting us on a trajectory that we can't afford and we can't handle. And industry is the living experience of that, but so too are households. There's people tonight that won't be able to afford to put dinner on the table. That's an indictment on our country, as rich as what we are, that there are Australians tonight that can't afford to have dinner.
We've got a lot of detail to get through. How will the new coalition plan reduce emissions?
Well, again, what we've said is that we will take a technology agnostic approach, understand the technologies in the energy system, things like carbon capture storage, and even batteries.
Which isn't a proven or large scale technology at the moment, is it?
Well, nor are batteries, Sally. You only have to look at the news last week to $1 billion blown just outside Sydney on what was meant to be the biggest battery. So are you saying that you shouldn't put the same lens against technology on carbon capture storage, which is being utilised here in Australia for the gas industry down in South Australia, and there's more development, and the world is developing that as they are developing other technologies in batteries and others and nuclear energy? Why wouldn't we open our minds to all the solutions? If we get back to first principles, we want to reduce emissions, we want to keep pace with the rest of the world, we don't want to streak ahead because you're experiencing the pain of that. So why wouldn't we say open our mind and buy us time for the technologies to catch up and the cost of those technologies to catch up, and we can still reduce emissions across sectors, and that's in a sensible, methodical way, a cheaper, better, fairer way that we live up to what we're going to do internationally, but take the pressure off households and business.
Would the coalition in government underwrite new coal as part of the capacity investment scheme, or are there additional subsidies you're willing to offer to new coal developments?
No, we're saying it's a technology agnostic. What happens for one technology should happen for them all. And what we want to do is get our energy operator back to the principle.
But to be clear, will there be additional subsidies in addition to the capacity investment scheme, which you're saying will be technology agnostic?
No, we've only announced that around what is currently available to keep capacity in the grid. That's common sense, and that builds that time for transitions away, and then the market will decide. The market will determine. And whether there's a proponent that wants to come forward, but the essence is that we'll treat everything equally.
Leader of the Nationals and the Shadow Minister for Agriculture, David Littleproud there, speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. Well, let's head overseas because there is tension within the Republican Party today after US President Donald Trump withdrew his support for Marjorie Taylor Greene, blasting the Georgia Congresswoman as a traitor. It comes after Ms. Greene, who was one of the president's strongest MAGA allies, backed this push to release more files linked to the late pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Ms. Greene says Donald Trump's online attacks have now put her in danger by fueling threats against her. And this morning, she said that while she's hurt by the attacks, she remains supportive of his administration. So, is Marjorie Taylor Greene's career now in peril? Or is this putting actual pressure on President Trump? Former Republican strategist Matt Klink gave Sally his opinion.
I think that the spat between Marjorie Taylor Greene and Donald Trump is less about MAGA and more about Marjorie Taylor Greene just being quirky. I mean, let's not forget that she was someone whose views are fairly fringe, and so much so that the mainstream media wouldn't put her on television. That is until she started to charge off after Donald Trump as it relates to the Epstein files and subsidies for Obamacare. So it's interesting. I guess it's the classic, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So, but she's made some hay. Donald Trump has criticized her. And now it's an open and public spat that Representative Green will ultimately lose, given that Donald Trump has the bully pulpit.
What can we expect from this week's vote on releasing more of the files? And what do you think it could mean politically, Matt?
Well, I think that the vote will ultimately pass. They're using something in the House that's called a discharge petition, where if you get 218 votes, which is a majority of the 435 members, you have to bring something to the floor, even if the majority party doesn't want it. So enough Republicans have teamed up with Democrats to move this discharge petition forward. Ultimately, look, I think that they'll probably vote to release as many of the files as they can. If the Trump administration were smart, they would just say, release all of them to the extent that you can without harming people, i.e. the minors at the time who are listed by name in the files. But just get all of the information out there and end it once and for all. We know that Trump is mentioned in those files. But we don't believe that there is anything that he did that's nefarious, bad, or illegal. But there are probably some other high-profile people in there across the board on both sides of the political aisle. Just get it all out there, and then at least the debate is over who's mentioned and what's said, as opposed to what are we not seeing and what are they hiding.
Where does this leave Marjorie Taylor Greene now? We've seen an update in the New York Times saying that she expresses her support for President Trump despite his criticism, but he's hit out hard at her, calling her a traitor and a disgrace as well. How does all this end for her?
Well, it probably ends poorly. She was going to try to run for governor of Georgia. She represents a district in that state. Trump would not back her. She decided to run for re-election. I don't know what she was thinking about how she could criticize Donald Trump. But again, it's not just the Epstein files. It's also the Obamacare subsidies that the Democrats, mind you, no Republican has ever voted for these Obamacare subsidies. So Marjorie Taylor Greene was talking favorably about the subsidies, which kind of flies in the face of everything that the Republicans are trying to do. Donald Trump has struck back hard, as he does, as your listeners, I'm sure, are aware. And she probably will get primaried, meaning that she will get a Republican challenger in the primary, and she may not make it into a general election in November of 2026.
So, tough times ahead, potentially, for Marjorie Taylor Greene. You were just listening to the former Republican strategist, Matt Klink. You'd think that swim between the flags is a pretty commonly understood surf life-saving message here in Australia. But experts are worried that they're being misunderstood by migrants and tourists, leaving them to worry about the summer season ahead. A total of 357 people drowned in Australia in the past financial year, and around a third of them were born overseas. A Monash University study has found that surf lifesaving programs are either inaccessible or not inclusive to tourists and migrants. Misaki Shibata is the researcher behind that study, and he came on this morning with Feroz Sata, the co-founder of Swim Brothers, which runs programs in multicultural communities to teach water safety. Misaki Shibata told Sally just how people were tending to get into trouble.
I think as a lifesaver, so I'm doing the lifesaving at Tamarama Beach, and Tamarama has the rip current, and typically on the left and the right side. When the people come in, they don't know where, because a lot of Australian comes in and check that. But whereas like a lot of, tourists just come to Tamarama, such a beautiful beach, but just a straight in without really checking anything. So I think that's one of the issues. But also red, yellow flags, Sometimes people are like, oh, what this, you know, deflux means. But then I actually started working on this, you know, project as well as previous work.
And what were you finding? Even with simple things like swim between the flags, there were misinterpretations and things were kind of getting lost in translation with that message, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, so my previous work actually, doing a survey in a Bondi beach, and about 30% of the beachgoers thought they have to be a swimmer between the flags. So in other words, that if they can't or if they don't swim, then they have to stay outside of flags. So that was the, some people's, you know, misinterpretations. But then the new study, we focus on South Korean university students. So we ask them, you know, how do you interpret those red and yellow flags if you see them? And only 14% said that indicates safety zone, but 70% said that or thought that they thought that these flags actually indicating danger zone.
That's worrying. Feral, how confusing can those signs and flags be to new and linguistically diverse Australians?
It can offer some confusion, and absolutely what the research from Monash University in terms of them indicating danger zones is what we've seen and heard as well. But equally, as such, many of new arrivals and people from culturally diverse communities also have some intentionality in opting to go for quieter beaches, and they do that for a whole range of reasons as well. So I think the messaging around swimming between the flags is absolutely critical and essential, but it needs to go a step further in terms of if people are choosing to swim at other locations, what are the things that you really need to look out for to ensure that yourself and your family and communities can be safe whilst doing so?
Feroz, what kind of work are you doing with Swim Brothers?
At the moment, we're really focusing on refugee, low socioeconomic and migrant communities. And the reason we're doing that is, I mean, swim and surf lifesaving is so synonymous with Aussie culture, but often white Aussie culture. And that's not to say that organisations don't want to be inclusive, but perhaps that messaging and the nuances isn't getting out there. So what we're doing is we're working really closely with our fantastic partners at Cronulla, at Sutherland Shire Lifeguards, at Wanda Surf Lifesaving Club and Surf Lifesaving New South Wales to bring communities into the pathways to become surf lifesavers and create that ripple on generational change.
It's fantastic. Misaki, with some of this really basic stuff, particularly with confusion around the flags, which sounds like it's quite widespread, what do we do about that? Is it handing out messages on the beach, or how do you do that? Because some people might be tourists who are only in the country for a short time. How do we get those messages out?
Yeah, so I mean, the first things in terms of swim between the flags, our research team proposing that we should change it to stay between the flags rather than swim between the flags. As a researcher, I've done a lot of workshop and stuff like that. But at the same time, I realize that a lot of people who come to workshops are good ones in a way that they are already aware. That's why they wanted to learn. So I think the challenge is how do we deliver these messages to those who are not aware of the the danger, who are not aware or who are just not, who just simply ignore our message. I think that's really the challenge.
Misaki Shibata is a lecturer and a researcher at Monash University, as well as a surf lifesaver, and Feroz Sata is the co-founder of Swim Brothers. Well, thank you very much for listening to The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview that you heard was presented by Sally Sara, produced by the Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Louise Mylan. I'm Luke Sidham Dunton, and Radio National Breakfast will be back tomorrow morning at 5:30 a.m. on Radio National and the ABC Listen app. And sometime after that, you'll be able to catch The Breakfast Wrap on the ABC Listen app and on Radio National at 11:30. So don't miss it. We'll see you tomorrow.